Welcome. This is the UX Design Cast podcast series, and my name is Carl Vredenberg. This is episode number 27 in the series, and this is one of our monthly design news panel sessions, and I'm delighted to have with us today our regular panelists, as well as an expanded list of panelists as well that I'd like to introduce you to. And starting off first with Val Fox, who is the Director of Innovative Technology Solutions at Ryerson University. Welcome, Val.
Hi.
And next we have Keith Instone, who is Information Architecture Lead with IBM CIO's office and has responsibility for IBM.com. Welcome, Keith.
Hi, Carl.
And next we have Eliane Tozman, who is User Interface Designer, the IBM Media Design Studio. Welcome, Eliane.
Hi, Carl.
And last, but certainly not least, is the newest addition to our panel, who is Jay Trimble, who is the group lead for the User-Centered Technology Group at NASA Ames Research Center. Welcome, Jay.
Thanks, Carl.
Well, so we've been having a rather amazing month, or a little longer, I think, since the last of these sessions. And there's been a whole lot of things happening that have implications with regard to design. And so we've got a list prepared that we're going to go through, where each of the panelists has thought about what is unique and newsworthy with regard to design for this last period. And so let's get started down that list. And the first one that we wanted to talk about is actually the Palm Pre and the Palm Web OS. So Eliane Tozman is the one that first brought that to our attention for a recommendation for today. So let me turn it over to Eliane, who can provide an overview of that particular item. Eliane?
Thanks, Carl. Yes, Palm recently launched a new phone called the Palm Pre. Now, just a little bit of history with the Palm. Everyone, when the Palm first came out as a PDA, it was truly a revolutionary device. And a lot of people have been waiting for the next generation Palm, so they took their time. They really thought about the design, and they came out with what is called the Palm Pre. Now, the Palm Pre is really an exceptional device in many, many ways. Not only is it intuitive in terms of the industrial design aspect, the outer shell, it's like a polished stone. It's round and it fits perfectly in your palm. It resembles like a black ball. So it doesn't have those sharp edges like most mobile devices. It's round. It has a very rounded feel to it, so that's really kind of revolutionary in that sense. The keypad also slides up from the bottom and offers larger than usual keys, so you're not stuck pushing these little tiny little things. They're good, they're solid, and it's a solid device. So putting aside the really sleek industrial design of the phone, I'd like to talk about the user interface. Now, this phone not only offers the standard text messaging, games, calendar, video, and music, and even image components, all of which are completely stellar. I was looking at pictures that someone took with the new Palm Pre, and it looks like a picture that someone took from their own digital camera. It is truly an exceptional picture. I mean, it's clear, it's not fuzzy, like the usual pictures that you see, even with my phone that I take, I'm always dumping them. And I saw these pictures and I was just blown away by the quality. So you've got all these components that standard mobile devices offer all in one, which are, terrific in many aspects. But really, what stood out for me from reviewing this was that it offered all these components as one, meaning that you could multitask. It's the ultimate multitasking device. Let's say I'm text messaging my friend in Orlando, and then I have a pop-up, MSN pop-up that just comes up from my friend in let's say, New York City. Now, I don't have to interrupt my text message that I'm doing. I can actually do both at the same time. I don't have to I don't have to leave one and go into the other. I can do both at the same time. I can even browse at the same time. So I can do all this. It's like a miniature PC on your mobile device, and I don't have to leave one application to go into another, which is truly incredible. I have not seen this before. So you can actually browse, text message, use the phone all at once. Now, that is all great, but what it also offered is a search mechanism. So you can actually, so it offers you the search, but it preloads it. You can actually search. It allows you to say, so you want to search. Where do you want to search from? Do you want to search Google, Google Max, Wikipedia, or Twitter? So you can actually choose that, and you can search one of those search mechanisms. Which I really thought that was that was incredible. And now let's say I'm searching and I get I've put something on my calendar. Now it notifies me that I have an appointment at 9 o'clock all the way across town, and it'll give me a notification. Now it won't interrupt what I'm doing. It'll just give a very subtle notification at the bottom of the screen. It's very subtle. It doesn't overpower you, and you can actually continue what you're doing. See that you have a notification that you have to go somewhere or whatever, and it doesn't jar you from what you're currently doing. Same thing if you get a phone call, you don't have to stop with what you're doing. You can actually choose to ignore the phone call or actually pick up the phone. All of this is, when I was reading it, the capabilities that it had just blew me away in terms of having all this in a phone. Now, so I've talked about the design both inside and out, and I just want to take a moment and talk about the guts of the phone, which is the operating system called the Palm OS, Web OS. Now, this is the Palm's next generation operating system built on Linux. So it's an all open source. And what it allows you to do is it allows you to host custom user interface browser technology. So it actually allows you to download widgets. And how it allows you to do this is that applications are actually built on native using standard web standards such as HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. So unlike most mobile devices, it's actually built on native web technology. So it's not like most mobile devices; they actually code it using their own proprietary language. This is not coded using proprietary language, it's actually coded using open source technology. So this allows for developers a whole new world. You have a whole new world out there. You can actually download. You're actually using this Palm Pre as a computer as well. You can actually have widgets that, on your desktop, on your web, on your mobile desktop. Let's say you can check the stock market, you can check the weather, and all this you can add like you do on your PC on your desktop. You don't have to go through the browser to check the weather like you do with most mobile devices. So that was, when I read about that, I was just, I thought that was just incredible. And it's something that we haven't seen. And it's very exciting for developers and for designers to actually, have something like this come out. So, as a whole, the new Palm Pre is pretty incredible. And I can tell you, when it does come out in Canada, I'll be first in line to go buy it.
I think what's really cool about what you just did, Eliane, is that you did that entire description without reference to the iPhone. And congratulations for doing that, because virtually nobody has ever done that. Most of the reviews that you hear of the Palm Pre is just, is it really the iPhone killer? And I think what you've done is really drawn attention to the design elements in terms of the actual user experience design, where people have talked about it, and people that have also, worked with it directly, that have said that in relation to the iPhone, that this Palm Pre has, in many reviews, bettered the design, improved upon significantly the actual user experience design from the point of view of the actual fit and finish of the hardware, the actual industrial design of it. Like you say, it was designed to feel like a pebble. The actual UI design of it, the notion of not only the capability for doing the multitasking, but the way that you actually can slide from one task to another, the way that that's done in the actual UI is also rather dramatic. And the other point that you make that very few people actually draw attention to is the nature of the Web OS. And lots of people don't know why it's called the Web OS either. But the real, I think, innovation here is that you don't need to, as you say, actually build using, you know, Objective-C or any other dedicated, you know, language just for that device. Anybody that has any of the skills to develop, you know, HTML, CSS, JavaScript can actually build apps, not just that run in a browser on the device, but can actually develop the native apps that then have direct access to all the, you know, components within the phone as well. So I think this is an instance, and I love that you started from talking about, you know, the Palm Pilot and what it did. And everybody knows that Palm was truly in this innovative space in terms of coming up with something truly easy to use. And I think the pre and the WebOS really is raising the bar now for these kinds of devices, you know, in the future that currently we've only had one serious entry in. And it also reinforces the notion that all the other Me Too iPhone type application devices have, and phone, you know, smartphone devices have missed the mark many of the times because they don't have the fit and finish. They don't have the design expertise. They don't have the notion of the ease with which you need to, you know, use it, and also the ease with which you want to go ahead and develop for it as well, and then still have the superior user interface and user experience. They've missed those marks in a variety of ways. And I think everybody has agreed that the Palm Pre has really hit all of those right on the mark. Anybody else have any comments with regard to the Palm Pre or the WebOS?
I have a comment in that just recently we've been looking at creating mobile devices, mobile apps for Ryerson University, and we have a problem because we don't really know how what to develop it on. So right now we're taking a web-based approach, and so we're creating our applications as web-based apps, and so that they'll run on any phone, but it's not optimum. So I'm absolutely thrilled to hear about this, and I can't wait to see the apps that we start developing web-based on the Palm Pre, because I think it's going to work a hell of a lot nicer on the Palm Pre than it will appear on the other phones. And what it means is that for the other phones or the other mobile devices, we're going to have to create extra, we're going to have to do extra things to create the type of experience that we want.
Yeah, to make a native app, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll see where this goes. I mean, it's very early days, but from a design point of view, I think we've got two significant innovations here, both the actual device and the, you know, the underlying infrastructure that also, I think, has a lot to say to the whole notion of ease of development and also the quality of the actual experience once you've developed it as well. So some exciting news in this last month on that, and we'll look forward to the progression of that particular topic. Any final thoughts on that one before we go on to the next topic?
You know, I'm wondering about the significance of multitasking on a phone and what the actual need is there on a screen that size, you know, as opposed to, say, task switching. And I think efficient task switching is very important. And I could see the need for messaging and certain things to be going on in the background. But I also think battery life on a phone is a big deal when you start to use it like a laptop. And I would just contrast the need for effective task switching from necessarily the need for full multitasking on a phone.
And that may be a statement in time, right? Whereas if you get to the point where you say, okay, there's not a hit to battery life, would I really want to do multitasking any less on a mobile device than on a desktop? I don't know.
I'm almost going from, you know, after 2 years of using the iPhone, the only time I've ever felt like I wanted to multitask was I want to have my IM up, for example, and be able to do other things. I think the task switching interface on a mobile phone is almost as important to be able to do that efficiently as it is to multitask, and time will tell.
The studies that we keep hearing is the fact that at least our students are going to be using their mobile devices more and more over the years, and we're seeing that the numbers are increasing with each number of students that are coming in every year, and we think in the next 2 years that we figure at least 70% of our students are going to be doing some sort of work on their mobile devices. So what is also intriguing is, as you say, how are they going to be using the phone, and what is the best way that they're going to be using the applications, and are they going to be multitasking or not? I'm not sure, but I just know that they're going to be using it instead of their laptops, and so it'll be a curious thing.
I was just thinking, actually, what both of you have been saying. I mean, task switching on a mobile device is you're not multitasking in that you don't ever really use two apps at the exact same time. So you're not actually sharing two windows on the same device. You are fundamentally task switching. The question is really whether the task user switched from, Jay, whether that keeps running or not is the only distinction, right?
Which is why I think for something like instant messaging, it's important, you know, and the notification that the pre has, I think that's significant to be able to go into another task and still be able to communicate.
Yeah, and I think it might be useful as people start to do more complicated things, they're going to try to accomplish one task, but they're going to need to be in a couple different applications. Right, so it sounds like from what I'm reading here, that's going to be a lot easier rather than, just locking into your Google Maps and your instant messaging and switching back and forth because they're two separate tasks. It's one task for you and you need to hop back and forth to get your stuff done.
Interestingly enough, too, on the pre site itself, one of the key things that it offers in terms of accessories is charging kits. So that's right on top. It says, you should actually get charging kits because I think, and Jay, you made a really good point by saying, well, it taxes your battery, right? So they say, well, we understand that. And here, if you get these kits, you can quickly change batteries. If you think that you're running low, you can just switch your battery so that erases that problem, which is problematic because it is very taxing on your system.
And apparently the actual cradle that you go and charge this on is apparently unique too. And this is sight unseen. We're not users of the device yet, but people are now. And I've heard reports of that being particularly innovative as well. It has some kinds of sticky surface that is like tacky, will actually stick to surfaces, but is easy to pull off too. So there's some innovative design work that went into even those cradles. So I think one of the things that I would take from this is, this is another instance of a company that is contributing to really the excellence in design that we've seen a number of companies now driving for. And I think for the disciplines that we represent, on this panel and on this podcast, I think this is just really good news that we've got continuing focus on better and better design of everything from an overall user experience point of view, as well as on the industrial design, visual design elements of this as well. And I think the more we have companies contributing products that have those kinds of characteristics, the more we'll be seeing the bar raised across the board for the contributions that the various disciplines that we represent here will be making. And so I think it's just really great news when we see this kind of thing. So speaking of the disciplines that make up user experience and design, I wanted to go next to Keith Instone, who is really well connected to the community of professionals across the industries. And he is a regular person that goes to attend conferences and presents at those conferences and the like as well. And so he's just gone to the Usability Professionals Association conference recently. And just wanted to ask Keith to give us a quick report on that conference and insights from it as well. Keith?
Sure. Thanks, Carl. Yeah, it was in Portland a few weeks ago. I told people I went out to Portland to visit my sister, and while I was there, I went to the conference. So always trying to mix the business and the family stuff. But it was a very good conference. There were definitely a lot of sessions on Agile. So if folks are interested in that, there will be documents and everything. I don't think they have the full proceedings online yet. But if you're into Agile and user experience, there were many, many sessions on that. Just some of the most interesting ones that I went to Nathan Shedroff's Designing Meaningful Experiences. And that was one of those sessions that I think it's going to take a couple years to really absorb it. But he's kind of really covering higher level things about how do we use design to communicate meaning to people, at a much higher level, like duty, redemption, and harmony, those sort of things. So it's going to take me a while to digest that one, but that was one that I bookmarked for links. I went to a good session from Aaron Marcus. He did a survey of different enterprise software companies and talked to you, Carl, right? And so he's going to be publishing a paper. So that he gave us sort of a sneak peek of the paper around some key enterprise software companies and what user experience means to them. But the one that I really wanted to feature was Chris Nodder's presentation that he did there called Evil by Design, and he has a website, usabilityforevil.com that I bookmarked. And it was, again, one of those that sort of got you out of your regular, you know, I'm a usability person, I should just focus on helping people complete their tasks and you know, that aspect of user experience. And he spent a lot of time talking about, well, what he defined as evil. You know, we could argue about the definition of evil, but he used the definition of to discover purposefully designed interfaces which make users emotionally involved in doing something that benefits you more than them. Right, so it's starting to get into be sort of being manipulative of our users. So not just sort of serving our users, but you know, getting them to do what you want them to do, whether it's buy your products or, you know, tweet your news item or whatever. And so he sort of, you know, he made it very humorous with references to you know, the evil side of things. And so his website's good to go through. Talking about things like, you know, well, people are lazy, right? Well, we know people are lazy, so what can you do as a designer, knowing the fact that people are lazy, right? You could have, you know, maybe you have a free version of your software and a version that they have to buy. Well, make the, you know, make the button for buying it, you know, a little bit easier to find than the button to download it for free, because people are lazy and they just might not bother looking for that free one. But he talked about pride, envy, lust, gluttony, you know, those sort of things, those bad things, but how we can use them to get people to do what we want them to do with our designs.
Found that site that you pointed to, and I should just mention that we will be including these links in the show notes that are available at uxdesigncast.com. There are also all, even the ones that we don't speak about here, but we've marked as being candidates, are also available in Delicious, tagged with UX Design Cast. So if anybody wants to look up these links, either one of those ways of getting at them will get you there. But it's interesting looking at the website, you know, the Evil by Design work, and going through each of those attributes, those terms that you just went through, Keith. And I think it sounds, you know, more negative, I think, than when you actually look at some of the ideas and the examples that are provided there that are actually really insightful for some real design techniques, especially in cases where you know, don't want to do just the obvious. You know, what kinds of things can you do from an overall, you know, business perspective to guide people to a particular location or whatever. So I agree that it was unique. I think it's nice every once in a while that you don't have all the standard kinds of topics, but you've got sort of a unique sort of perspective on it as well. And the other one, the Aaron Marcus piece, would work. A number of people that Aaron had worked with in the various companies. And as you said, Keith, we contributed from IBM with regard to this as well, to really provide a compendium of a set of answers to some core questions about the ways in which companies do their work and what kind of tools they use and all that kind of stuff. And so that's going to be in a series of conference sessions that Aaron's been leading, and also we'll be publishing those as well. So when those become available, it'll be good to direct people to them. Okay, any other comments or thoughts with regard to Keith's update?
Yeah, just that I went to the site, and I went to Pride, and one of the examples of Pride was LinkedIn, and it said, LinkedIn says, yeah, it needs your data in order for the site to be useful. So they use language like, your profile is incomplete. Oh dear. Well, that's exactly what happened to me, because when I was using LinkedIn, it would tell me that I had never filled up my entire profile and was always nagging at me. And I did feel, oh my goodness, I absolutely have to do that. Very compelled to do that. So I thought, what a great motivator.
That's the example, in fact, that I was trying to think of it, Val, and I'm glad you're sharing a brain on this one, because that's what I meant about a positive thing. So it's not just that it's malicious, but if you want to incent people to complete a profile, you know, to say that you're 30% complete, who wants to be 30% complete, right? So it's looking at the various aspects of the sort of human emotion and using those in design. That's a very good, I think, positive example of, you know, where you want to take those things into consideration in your design. And it's not the way that you would normally you think of just designing something just so that it'll be usable, right?
Right, yeah, and I think Chris just done a really good job of using the evil angle to make it more interesting. But yes, there are really positive suggestions in here and positive things that you can do. But he has that. And the other part that actually convinced me to go to his talk in the first place was I saw him at lunch, and he had a usability for evil T-shirt on. Mm. And then, you know, he gave me a little description of what his talk was. Well, you know, this guy's serious. He's made a T-shirt about his talk. Not everybody does that at a conference. And now if you actually go there, you can buy all sorts of stuff with his logo on it, right? Mm-hmm. So he's sort of, you know, in a sense, doing a little bit of evil, even talking about evil by design.
I was just going to say
that. Get us to buy stuff, yes.
I was just going to say that. It's also, he grabs the attention. He's using the very technique himself to come up with that term to draw a lot of attention to, because, you know, somebody that lists evil and anything, and sex and anything,
right,
will generate a lot of attention, which is also what he talks about on the site. So, yeah, no, a wonderful example of, you know, some designer thinking that's thinking a bit more out of the box. And I think we need, especially in this kind of economic climate, I think we need that kind of thinking to really differentiate some of the design work, you know, we're doing. You know, one of the things I wanted to go on to next, when you talk about sort of human characteristics and really appealing to them, I wanted to talk about this new term that people have been using of real-time web. And this is all about, you know, Web 0.1, Web 2.0 being collaborative and two-way. You could contribute comments and stuff like that. And people have talked about sort of the next, well, there's all kinds of definitions of what Web 3.0 might be. But this term of real-time web is really being kicked around right now as a description for a trend that is satisfying, I think, a human need for urgency. I want everything now. And there's a announcement that happened this last month too from Google, called Google Wave, that is a project they're working on. And it's the folks that initially put the Google Maps piece of work together, which has been very, very, very popular. And they're looking at sort of taking email to the next level, that this would be it's a very hard project to describe, actually, but the core elements that I wanted to just draw attention to here from a design point of view is this human desire for immediacy and not having to wait, right? So we used to have email, you'd send an email and you have to wait for the thing to come back. Then we had, you know, instant messaging and texting, and, you know, you've got some communication happening that's more instantaneous. And everybody that's looked at, and I know, Val, you've talked about this before too with your students at Ryerson, a lot of them are using these instant communication mechanisms, you know, much more than the email and anything else that's a little slower. And so what's interesting, I think, about the Google Wave announcement is this notion of taking these conversations and taking this concept that's in a whole lot of email clients now, but including, you know, Gmail of conversations. We also have those in IBM Lotus Notes email too. And also, though, adding a capability for real-time updating. And the most dramatic part of the demonstration here is when you have a chat message with someone, you don't just see that they're typing. You know, we're using Skype for this call. And when you look at Skype, you see that somebody is writing back, but you don't get to see what they're writing until they have pressed enter. So you still, even though it's immediate, it's not super immediate. You're not actually seeing things instantaneously. But whereas with this Google Wave, by example here, as you key in the T of the in a message that I might be sending, for example, to any of you, you actually see that T, then you see the H, then you see the E. So it's instantaneously communicating back and forth one another. I think that reinforces this human desire for urgent and real-time sort of updating. There's also a notion of embedding that's around with regard to this Google Wave piece, that you could take any of these waves of these or these conversations and place them on websites, put them anywhere you want. It also includes another key feature that everybody, I think, that's been using the web for a while also expects as well, and that is be able to have instant history, to be able to go back in time and find everything you did and be able to track back even the old change history, but not in any sort of convoluted way, just completely being able to replay it. And so I think there's been some really interesting design ideas kicking around in this Google Wave that I think are dramatic in the same way that you were just talking, Keith, about some of the attributes that the Evil by Design is trying to appeal to. I think that this piece, and I think increasingly applications, will also be needing to be designed to address this human desire for immediacy. And I just wanted to add one other quick thought before I ask for all of your comments on it. I wanted to also comment that, you know, Twitter is very much an immediate feedback piece as well on a grand scale. And it's interesting, and it's very popular. It's growing leaps and bounds. We also have, you know, Facebook, and Facebook is increasingly trying to be like Twitter in that same kind of attribute of immediacy and making information available to others. There was other news, very sad news, that also was communicated recently on Twitter. And it was interesting. People have talked about, you know, that traditional media is dying, largely because it isn't immediate, right? And it was interesting to see what happened with regard to news stories recently that were just, you know, dramatic on Twitter, that the traditional media, I think, also felt this incredible need to actually respond quickly, even though they didn't have much information. And so, you know, the news stories actually all referred to only one, you know, website's news. But even traditional media sort of broke their own rules of having to go and validate that they've got appropriate sources just to be quick, to be able to be out there with the information that people were looking for. And so there seems to be this incredible desire right now, and I think it has an impact on anyone designing anything these days, because we've got people expecting getting information instantly or as close to instantly as possible. So I thought that was another trend that was reinforced, I think, in a variety of ways this last month. And so I wanted to raise that one here as well. Anybody have any comments on those?
I'm excited about using Google Wave, and I'm eager to see how it works. And I find myself thinking, in our desire for immediacy, of course, we can also sacrifice a part of the human experience that requires thought and contemplation. And I would hope we don't do one at the expense of the other, that we find a way for these things to coexist.
I think you're right. I think there are also instances where, you know, this and this kind of needing things to be immediate is something we need to factor in, though. I think that's the part that we need to grapple with as designers. We have a trend going on right now that is causing some, you know, unnatural things to happen. Like I was saying about the traditional media feeling this incredible need to be able to come up and validate a story within minutes of something happening, whereas in the past they would have been more careful with doing that kind of fact checking, and they're kind of having to throw that by the side and going for this immediacy thing. And I think there may well be a need to have a mechanism to address that, to be able to have an immediate response, but yet say, oh yeah, by the way, we're checking sources or whatever, but not be, you know, not having anything, you know, available on a website, for example.
So I think you're right. I'm thinking that that's such a reactive thing to happen. It is a reaction, but that the press is reacting and not doing their due diligence is actually, it's a throwback back to the users to say, well, what can I trust? I mean, I was thinking, well, it's kind of a little bit like Wikipedia too, because you wonder. There was a time when a lot of people didn't trust it, and now there is more trust, but people will still check other things out. So it is also causing people to change their behaviors of how they accept information and how they react to information. Right now it's new to us, so I actually think that we are going to react, and we're going to try to get on it as soon as possible and react to things. But I think that over time, people are going to now distrust that too, and we'll see other behaviors come out of it. So I think you're right.
So I think the takeaway from a lot of this, and also factoring in Jay's comment from earlier, is that, you know, these are some trends. These are some trends in design, some trends in getting at Keith's point that he took away from the UPA conference too, this whole notion of, you know, what kinds of attributes, what kinds of trends really are there with regard to understanding humans and also groups of humans, people who are trying to do certain things. And I think we're in an exciting time where we're seeing these kinds of technologies introduced, and we're in this large experiment in a way too, that we need to step back and say, okay, well, you know, there's a trend toward this. Yeah, let's satisfy that desire. But we also have to sort of build in these kinds of controls, getting back to Jay's point. I think, you know, okay, so we have an incident thing here. Well, but maybe this particular type of wave over here, or this kind of concept, maybe that's not appropriate for this particular situation, and that you have a way of backing off of that one. So I think we're going to learn that as we go. I think Keith has made the point many times in previous podcast too, that, you know, five steps forward, you know, one step back from that, just to be a little more cautious and to look at what we've learned and sort of build in the next sort of rev of this. But I think as designers and as people who are interested in design, I think we're seeing some really dramatic changes that I think everybody needs to understand and also build into the work that they do as well. So I think it's been a really exciting time. I wanted to also just mention that I wanted to introduce a new feature into the podcast series, and that is to come up with, during each of these monthly sessions, a website that might be interesting for everybody that's listening to this to go and give a try. And because it has implications in terms of interest in design, various design features of it, also just in overall user experience, or just insight into various ways of using technology. And the one that I was going to suggest for this month is a website that's called specify.com. It's basically specify with the C in the middle, change to Z if you're in the US, and if you're elsewhere speaking English, you would use the Z letter. And it's basically a search engine of sorts, and you can pull all kinds of interesting attributes about that particular thing you're searching for. It also provides a scrapbook looking collection of visuals onto a canvas that then you can look at as well. So you might want to try it for your name, or you might want to try it for any number of concepts that you might want to look for. But it's truly a fun thing to try. And so I would recommend you go and give a try to specify.com. Also wanted to add a new feature too, where we talk about the community, the broader user experience and design and related disciplines, and what's going on in the community. Now, Keith had mentioned earlier the conference and the like, and that's sort of a community news kind of thing. But I wanted to also just ask Keith to tell us about one other piece of community sort of relevant information that you can share now too. Keith?
Yeah, thanks. So the Interaction Design Association, IXDA, is sort of that's a newer professional organization. They say that they don't have membership, but they do have members. And so they've been working on trying to build up their infrastructure to serve those members. And they sort of had a bake sale, or, you know, a fundraising event this week, trying to raise some money, since you don't actually, you can get a lot of benefit from IXDA, but you don't really have to pay to be a member. So they're saying, okay, you know, how much are we actually worth to you? And people are donating money. By the time you hear the podcast, the official fundraising might be over, but I'm sure they'll still take donations. But it's just an interesting sort of a trend in the user experience community. There's a lot more grassroots efforts. You know, there's the UX book clubs that are coming up and so on. And so for some of us old timers that sort of grew up with a different way to be part of the user experience community by being a UPA professional or joining ACM SIGCHI, this is sort of maybe like the next generation of user experience professionals. This is how they're getting together. This is how they're forming their community. So if you're not aware of IXDA, check them out. There's a lot of energy happening there, right? So check them out. If you currently get value from them, go ahead and donate, and we'll see if this new model of sort of user experience community building, you know, how far they can take it.
In fact, that organization is also involved with the Mozilla Labs on a design challenge that I know I've tweeted about before too, and I'll include a link in as well, where Mozilla Labs did a design challenge for new design for coming up with tabs and in a browser, and I think they had some significant number of entries that they're now voting on. Anyway, I'll leave a link in the show notes for that as well. And while I'm on the topic of the show notes, you can go to, as I mentioned earlier, uxdesigncast.com. You can play this podcast there. You can also look at the show notes and the links there. You can also get it in iTunes. Just go into the iTunes store, go to the search box, and key in UX Design Cast. So you can subscribe to it there as well, and it'll download to a device that you used for listening to this automatically each time it's available. Might also want to direct you to the IBM Design site, which is available at ibm.com/design. We also have a Twitter account. We have to be on every single one of these social networking sites, but the name there is IBM Design. We're also on Facebook, and we do have a vanity or URL, or we will get one at the end of this month, because that is the time that Facebook is actually allowing us to create vanity ones. But right now, the recommendation is to go to Facebook, go in the search box there, and look for Design at IBM. That's sort of the topics for this session. I want to thank Val, Keith, Eliane, and Jay for your contributions to this episode of the UX Design Podcast, and we will talk to you all next time. Thank you all. Thank you all for listening to, and we'll talk to you all next time, and bye for now.